This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Audible.com, offering the largest selection of audiobooks for your smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
I'm Jeff Combs. I'm everywhere on Star Trek, and you keep tuning in to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 177. We have found all the culture. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me this week is Philip Gilfus. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including the passing of Grace Lee Whitney, and Jonathan Frakes' comments about the future of Star Trek on TV. Then in the feature, we're joined by Andy Vanderkolk and Daniel Prue to discuss the classic episode, The City on the Edge of Forever. So let's step into The Ready Room. Hello, Philip. It's great to have you here with me in the Ready Room for a TOS show today, and I'm really curious to find out what it reminds you of from the world of TNG. How's everything going?
It's going great, Chris. Have a theater gig coming up and been writing some plays and all that. And, you know, the one weird thing about doing a TOS Ready Room is that there is no TOS Ready Room. So where are we sitting right now?
Well, we're in the alternate future where Edith Keeler lived and Germany won the war and 23rd century starships have ready rooms.
Well, I think the Mirror Universe has great ready rooms because that was one good thing that the Mirror Universe could do.
Yes.
They knew how to make a good ready room.
They really did. So before we jump into news, quickly, you have to tell me because I always like to hear about your theatrical endeavors there. What's your theater gig coming up?
It's a dinner theater or a murder mystery dinner theater.
Oh, does someone get an overdose of drugs and go crazy?
Well, there's two ways it could end. They could either die, or actually, now that I think about it, they must die.
Oh, they must die. Okay.
Yeah. So this is my second time doing it. It's pretty cool because it's a little more free-flowing theater where, okay, you know, I'm used to, like, you know, you have to stand here, do this, but it's pretty much like just walk among the audience and say lines and wait till someone dies.
Now, I think I remember when you did the first one. I think I remember you telling me about, I remember the dinner murder mystery.
Yeah. This is going to be interesting because the first one was sort of like a wedding party. And so, like, I was like the best man or whatever. This one is set in a Renaissance fair. And so it's like a small town putting on a Renaissance fair. So I have no idea what kind of costume I'll be wearing. I'm having a flashback to, you know, your DS9 characters of Kira and Dax, no, you know, wearing their hats.
Clearly, you need to dress as Spock and go there with your tricorder.
And that's what I'm thinking. And I'll just be watching it halfway through the play and going, I'm a fool. I could have been recording the whole time.
I have failed to tape hours of living murder mystery.
There's so much culture I could have been recording.
You need to save that. All right. So let's talk about the news today. We have two stories to talk about. And the first one is a very sad one. And it has been a really tough year for us in the world of Star Trek and all the people that we have been losing. Of course, Leonard Nimoy passed away. Harv Bennett passed away. And then on May 1st, Grace Lee Whitney, who played Yeoman Rand, passed away. And she died of natural causes, and she also died at the age of 85. And I guess it's a mark, Philip, of how long Star Trek's been around and how we're all obviously getting much older. Because when I first heard the news that Grace Lee Whitney passed away, I felt like, oh, already? Because I was thinking that she was a lot younger than 85.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those things, and not to be an ageist, but, like, you know, over the past, you know, 10, 20 years where it's like Jimmy Doohan and then D. Kelly, and you're kind of like, you know, it's very sad, of course, but you're like, well, you know, they were sort of the quote-unquote older, you know, members of the cast. So, you know, it's not a huge surprise that just, you know, almost 50 years later.
Yeah.
But you, like you said, Yeoman Rand, it's you always think of it as like the young one. It's like hearing that, you know, Walt, you know, Chekhov, Walter Koenig, you know, died because, like, he's the young one, you know. So it is hard to picture these people who, you know, being such Trek fans that, you know, we sort of picture them eternally young, even though we did see them later in Star Trek as well, that it's sort of more of a shock than, say, the quote unquote older characters.
Yeah. Now, she only appeared in 8 episodes of the first season of the original series, yet she is one of the most memorable characters from TOS, I feel. And I hear that from other people. And we did, a couple of years ago, we did Buttons, illustrated Buttons for the network. And most of them are aliens, but we did one of Yeoman Rand. And it was extremely popular, even though she isn't there throughout the entire run of the series. People really latch on to this character.
Well, I mean, it's funny that in some ways, you know, when you think Star Wars, you get like the Princess Leia, you know, hair and all that. And when you say Star Trek, you kind of get the Spock ears, but like the female version of Star Trek is Yeoman Rand. It's the mini skirts, it's the go-go boots, it's the beehive hair.
Yeah,
I mean, that she did sort of create this iconic picture of Star Trek. Like you said, even though she wasn't in that many episodes, considering the 3 seasons and everything else, she's sort of iconically Star Trek.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like she was in way more than 8 episodes.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where, you know, there's so many stories. I mean, I'm sure there's only one because it's the only truth, but there's so many stories about, you know, how she left and why she left and blah, blah, blah. And I hope, and you may know this better than I do, I hope that her Star Trek experience wasn't totally bad, because I know she was dealing with a lot of things. But it's one of those things, like, to us, you know, her Star Trek time is great, or at least I think it is, that she played this memorable character that, you know, I hope that she was able to look on it as a good experience, because it is a good experience for us.
Yeah, definitely. So after the series, she did come back on the big screen. She was in the motion picture. She was in Star Trek 3, also Star Trek 4. Star Trek 6, they're on the Excelsior with Sulu, which means she was also in the Season 3 Voyager episode Flashback, which took place there on the Excelsior. And she even got into fan films later on. She did an episode of New Voyages Phase 2, and she was also in Star Trek of Gods and Men.
Yeah, and I think Grace Lee almost had that sort of, not that she's dead, but almost had that Denise Crosby moment of where, you know, maybe wherever she felt she left that character in the 60s, she got a chance to kind of, you know, bring it back and make it her own when she was on Voyager. You know, she's now a commander, and that's not just this, you know, sort of 60s stereotypical serving Dixie cups and all that. She actually gets to play a, you know, adult, real, you know, strong woman officer. And so I felt that was sort of maybe, hopefully she felt that way. That was her way to reclaim that character.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. So again, she passed away of natural causes. I don't know exactly what those were. And we're going to miss her contributions, but of course we can continue to watch her in Star Trek. And she did a lot of stuff after Star Trek as well. I'm personally not as familiar with her work there, but I do know that on TV she appeared in Batman, which I do remember watching as a kid. Also Police Story, The Virginian, Death Valley Days, and you might like this for your theatrical gig you have coming up, Diagnosis Murder.
Murder. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's to me, it's always fascinating, you know, being my age. And I mean, even your age, even though I know you're a little bit older than me. But like these sort of classic characters from TOS, like we know them from TOS, but like people like Grace Lee and D. Kelly all had these sort of classic careers, you know. But, you know, to us, they're sort of enshrined into Star Trek. But it's good to know that, you know, a lot of them had careers before and after. And all that.
Yeah. And those all came after Star Trek, the ones I named there. Now, before Star Trek, she did a lot of TV as well, including a couple of shows that I remember watching, Gunsmoke and Bewitched specifically.
And Some Like It Hot. I think that was the coolest one. You know, I remember that. I mean, you know, obviously way before my time, but I remember watching it. It's a very good classic black and white, funny movie, Marilyn Monroe, Jack Lemmon, all that. So if you've never seen that, definitely something to check out.
Definitely. And then also a few more, Surfside 6, The Untouchables, 77, Sunset Strip.
And Wagon Train, which, of course, famously is how Star Trek was pitched, as Wagon Train to the Stars.
Definitely. All right. So it's just amazing. I mean, she had a career of almost 70 years. So as a teenager, she set out on screen and then went from there. 70 years doing anything is just absolutely incredible. And so she will be very missed. But again, as I said, you can watch her in Star Trek and any of these other shows. And actually, it would be very interesting to go back and watch some of these really classic TV shows and see her appearances in those as well. All right, so let's go on to the next story here. And Philip, this is something that we have to talk about because it's being discussed, or it was discussed anyway, in our listeners group, the Babel Conference. And of course, it's all over the internet. This is Jonathan Frakes coming out saying, wait a minute, fans, don't get your hopes up. Star Trek is not coming back to TV. And because Jonathan Frakes said it, a lot of fans took that as being, oh my God, there's never going to be any more Star Trek, which I didn't get because I love Jonathan Frakes. I love Riker, always choose Riker. And he's not involved in Star Trek anymore. So how would he know what they're planning to do?
Well, what frustrates me a lot, Chris, especially, you know, being, you know, whatever part of Trek fandom, I don't know what level I'm at being a Star Trek co-host here, but being a part of Trek fandom, it frustrates me to read these headlines sometimes. So like the headline says, you know, Frakes, no Star Trek TV. And then, like, I'm reading the article and like, he did say that. He said that he pitched an idea. And this is years ago. This wasn't yesterday. This wasn't last month. This was like years ago.
Like 10 or more years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, yeah, this, and it's like before HD or something. No, I don't know. But anyway, like, you know, he's
so we'll write our dates now. BHD.
That's right. BBR before Blu-ray. But anyway, but like, you know, basically what he's saying is like, hey, I pitched, they weren't interested. So I, you know, my feeling was they weren't interested in looking at a TV. Possibly they weren't interested in his pitch, you know,
exactly,
or 5 years ago they weren't interested, you know. But the headline is Star Trek is not doing TV for the 50th anniversary. It's like that's not what he said, you know. And I mean, I'm not saying, you know, as Larry and others have famously said, you know, if there's a TV series in development, we would know. So it's not like there is one, but it doesn't mean like it's dead forever. So
I mean, I think the idea is being kicked around. Clearly, there's not a TV series in actual production right now, or else we would hear rumors about casting or something. It's just impossible to keep anything a secret these days. So we would hear something. Although, as we see with the next Star Trek film, apparently they're planning to put something out in 14 months and they don't have a finished script yet and they haven't casted the film. So who knows how quickly they think they can do this. But
so are you talking about Beyond?
Yeah, yeah. Beyond what?
Okay. Whoa, hold on, Chris. Are you telling me that they finally accepted my petition that this film be titled with punctuation so it can be read in your voice?
I hope.
So is it going to be? So can you please read the title with an exclamation point at the end?
Well, see, that's the thing. When I saw the title, Star Trek Beyond, I was like, meh, yeah, what does it mean anything? But then when I added the exclamation mark to it, suddenly I fell in love with it.
And could you give our listeners of what that track of that title would now sound like?
Yes. Coming summer 2016, Star Trek Beyond.
Now I'm excited. I'm excited, right? Now that I'm on board.
You want to know what it is beyond of, right?
Right. And I mean, you know, yeah, which I mean, that could be a whole news segment in of itself, that, but which I know you already did. But yeah, I just think it, you know, and in some ways, like, Chris, this asked me, I do have a question for you. So, like, you know, Frakes, who's wonderful, I mean, you know, he has pitched his idea. We know Dorn has pitched his idea. At this point, Chris, did you pitch Paramount and CBS an idea? Because apparently everyone has pitched their idea. So have you pitched CBS your idea for Star Trek on TV?
Well, of course I have, and I'm okay. sure I'm sure you know what it is without me even telling you.
Well, yeah, the Loeffler series.
It's called Star Trek hashtag Loeffler. So
Which I mean, I feel like, you know, like with Ad Midnight and everything else, that could work in the 21st
century. I felt, you know, since Ashley Judd decided she's not going to run for office, I figured she probably has some time. You know, maybe she needs something to do. And
I thought she's been elected senator of your heart.
Well, yeah, she has tenure. So what happened here, going back to Frakes, he was at an event called Fan Expo Regina in Canada, and this was on April 25th, and they were doing a Q&A session, and someone asked him about the possibility of a new Star Trek television series, because these days, when you meet someone that had anything to do with Star Trek, that's the first question that you ask.
Because they know.
Yeah, because everybody knows. They're all doing a great job of keeping it secret. So his response was that he had pitched a concept to CBS, which owns the rights to the franchise, and unfortunately, they don't seem to have any interest in a new Trek series. But again, as you said, I think that they don't have any interest in the idea that he pitched, not that they don't have any interest in a new Trek series. I think they have a lot of interest in a new Trek series.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's, I mean, you know, I wish it wasn't about money, but it's always going to be about money. So it's only going to happen when the stars align, to use a pun, I suppose. And, you know, with the third movie, that's got to be its own thing, I'm sure, even though, you know, the studio's Paramount, blah, 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 I know. But anyways, nevertheless, in the Star Trek universe, both literally and figuratively, I'm sure they need to let the third movie breathe before, you know, CBS is doing whatever it's doing.
Yeah, probably. Which is unfortunate, because we really need a new series in the 50th anniversary year. A third film in the, well, actually, it's the first film, Philip, in the Pegverse.
I never thought about it that way. Well, you know, as you famously know, that in the Star Trek gospel, it says, you know, upon Simon, I shall build my church. And so that's pretty much what's going to happen here. So, yeah.
So the other things he mentioned were, actually, if you go back, there's an old article on IO9, which we were looking at as well. And this is from 2011, and this is what Frakes said at that time. He said, I had a Star Trek that I developed for TV, and we were told in no uncertain terms that they said no to Bryan Singer, and we think he probably means Brian Fuller, television Star Trek. They said no to a William Shatner television Star Trek.
I'm telling you, everyone's pitching. Everyone's pitching.
They feel at CBS Paramount that they don't want to make the same mistake that's been made before, which was watering down the brand by having a TV show and a movie. So this is where you know that this is going back to them pitching something in the mid-2000s, right? Mm-hmm. Before the Abramsverse even started, because it would have been right on the heels of Enterprise. It's not applicable to 2015, where actually, coming up, next week, what is today? We're recording this on May 7th for me here in Japan, May 6th for you.
You're in the future.
See how time washes us to places, and you know.
Yeah, it's like a tide.
It is. Next week, May 15th, will be the 10th anniversary of the airing of the final episode of Enterprise.
Oh, Terra Prime?
Yes, the final episode of Enterprise, Terra Prime, as well as the final episode of The Next Generation for you there.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
10 years. It's 10, actually 10 years, an entire decade, with no new Star Trek.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, it's the Dark Ages, as we refer
to it. It is the Dark Ages, yes.
No, I mean, because then we leave out JJ, and I don't want to be one of those people. But yeah, so at least on TV.
No new Star Trek on television.
Yeah, no.
So, you know, it's been that long. He says, that's what happened with Star Trek Nemesis. And that's why I think Star Trek Enterprise didn't last the way they expected it to. It was the classic corporate greed of, we've got something good, so let's continue to milk it. And we milked it so dry that the fans had no appetite for a movie.
He really stretched that metaphor.
I know, right? So I can see Riker explaining this over drinks and 10 forward.
I just picture the milk in a bottle and like someone dropping it. And I don't know where this imagery comes from.
So I think what they've done by taking time off before the Abrams Star Trek, and they're doing it again because they haven't even begun to shoot the second one, is a much smarter business plan. Much to my chagrin, not that wouldn't love the Titan. I guess he means not that no one wouldn't love the Titan or the Rikers in Space or any of those shows on the air.
Rikers in Space.
I can see them flying around in the escape pod from Enterprise.
Yeah, that would be great. Because I would wonder which accent Troy would use in this new series.
All right. So that's what he said back then. And then he said something similar right now. And he once again pulled out the same thing about Enterprise and the same thing about Nemesis and the poor box office. Nemesis isn't the greatest film, but I think it's a pretty good movie. People forget that it opened against Harry Potter and like it opened against Lord of the Rings too, right? It opened against Harry Potter. Anyway, mm-hmm. all these movies were there at the same time, 2002, and it's just not really a fair assessment. At the end of the day, Jonathan Frakes does not know what CBS is planning for a new series. They weren't interested in what he pitched. That's it. There's nothing more to this. There will be a new series. There has to be a new series. I don't know if it'll happen in 2016, but don't think too much about this story that came out.
Yeah, because I mean, you know, in some ways, you know, we are I'll say me. I'm, you know, 34. I am the spoiled Trek generation. You know, I had four series, you know, all these movies to include the new JJs. And it's like, wow, I want my Star Trek on TV. It's like, you know, my dad had like one series when he was growing up. That's all you had. And so in some ways that, you know, the time between TOS and TNG, you know, that's about the time we're at right now almost. And so that's what they had to do back then. So I think we're kind of like, we want Trek on TV. Well, you know, wait and then it'll happen. You know, just enjoy all the, you know, thousands of episodes and hours and movies that we have now.
Yeah. And I will say when we finally do get a new series, I hope fans will embrace it and not whine and complain about it the way they did with Enterprise and turn it off. Because in the end, Enterprise got canceled in part because fans failed to support the show.
So was it like a reverse PBS? This cancellation is made possible right. by viewers like you.
Exactly. Enterprise is a good show. If you watch it, it's a good show. It just wasn't what you wanted at the time, so it wasn't supported, and it got canceled. And then we got no new Star Trek for 10 years, so let's not screw over the franchise when we get a new show this time around. But yeah, I think it'll be a very different show than anything we got before because TV has changed so much.
It is. And I think, you know, I'm both blessed and frustrated with fans because any, you know, slip of a rumor, thought, cough, sneeze, vomit of potential new series, you know, gets the biggest headline on my Facebook and Twitter feed. Which is both, you know, frustrating because, like, guys, it's, you know, just wait for an actual real person to say it. And but it's blessed because it speaks to the desperation of fans that we want a series so much that any scintilla of gossip we will take is maybe that's hope they're going to do it. But like it's just everyone just, you know, but watch Netflix and let it happen.
That's one reason why I'm so confident that there will be another series. CBS, they want to make money. They can see how much everyone wants a series. Let them do it right.
Yeah, everyone just take that energy and write petitions about Deep Space Nine on HD. That's what Chris wants you to do.
That's right. All right. Well, let's bring in our guests today, Daniel and Andy, and talk about some TOS. It's been nearly 50 years since Harlan Ellison penned the story of the Enterprise crew thrown back in time to 1930 New York. Well, actually, it was originally Chicago, but despite the changes that took place from paper to screen, The City on the Edge of Forever remains one of the most beloved Star Trek episodes of all time. It won the Hugo Award for Best Dramatic Presentation in 1968 and is the granddaddy of time travel stories. Today we're going to discuss this legendary episode, and to help us do that, we're joined, for some reason, by Philip's cohort from Earl Grey, our TNG show, Daniel Prue. Hey, Daniel, welcome.
Yeah, you've got two TNG guys on here, so...
We're flipping the table around today.
Yeah, so, I mean, I have a sinking feeling that TNG might be mentioned once or twice on this episode, so...
Yeah, I'm waiting to find out which TNG episode this reminds Philip of.
I have it written down already. I'm going to mention it.
And also joining us from Women at Warp, also known as First Time Trek on Twitter, it's our friend Andy Vanderkolk. Andy, welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me.
Great to have you here. Now, there's no Ninja Cat in this episode, but I'm sure you'll find something else to shout, right?
The show would be too awesome if you added Ninja Cat to it.
Well, there is a Ninja McCoy.
Yes, there is a Ninja McCoy.
They've changed the future. There's no more Ninja Cat. And the whole show collapses without it.
That's not a future I want to live in.
All right. So before we jump into the discussion, we always do a synopsis. I think this one is pretty quick. Everyone knows this episode. McCoy gets an overdose of drugs, goes crazy, goes down to a planet, jumps through, as we discussed, on the other side of the room.
The other side of the room.
The wardrobe from Narnia, and ends up in 1930 New York. Spock and Kirk have to go back and find him because he has changed history and Earth and Starfleet and the Enterprise, and pretty much nothing else we know exists except for Phillips. Was that a McCoy figure you just put in front of the screen?
Assassins! Assassins!
Assassins! Killers!
Murderers!
I didn't know we were bringing our toys today.
Oh, is this a toilet show? Oh, I'm sorry. I'm taking my headphones off.
So they go back. Kirk falls in love with Edith Keeler, who has a vision of the Star Trek future, but unfortunately, if she acts upon it, that future will never exist. In the end, everything is set right. Edith Keeler dies, as Spock said she must, and they come back to the planet, and then they're offered other trips to screw around with the past by the Guardian of Forever, which apparently... has no idea of the powers that it has and the havoc that it is wreaking on the timeline.
Well, when you create yourself, you don't have any worries that you'll be erased from time. I think that's what it was. Like he just had the ability just to be. So
the Guardian says that it is its own beginning and end. It's its own creator. But then later it says that I was made to show you the past in this manner only.
If only there was some other person we could think of in another series of some sort who says, I am the beginning, the end, the one who is many. What series was that? Daniel, can you help me? I'm drawing a blank.
I can't remember his name because I never remember the episode titles.
I think it was a her, maybe, actually. Maybe some sort of villain of a movie. It's blanking on me.
So what you're saying is that the Guardian of Forever is actually a shapeshifter, and so is the Borg Queen.
Yes. But which, is it Susanna or Alice? That's always the eternal question. I took that internet poll the other day.
It's only Alice.
Are you a Susanna or Alice?
It's only Alice.
Now, Chris, one thing you disappointed me in the synopsis is that you changed the wording, and you did not say the word that if you're playing the City on the Edge of Forever drinking game, anytime Edith Keeler must die is said... You must take a drink, which I think would be like 7-8 shots, I think.
It's a great line. I love that.
That should have been the title of the episode. Edith Keeler must die.
Must die.
Exclamation points in Chris Jones' voice.
Right, because we need more episode titles with exclamation marks in them.
Wasn't there a movie, Somebody Must Die?
Romeo Must Die.
Oh, that was one too, but that was not even who I was thinking of.
And then maybe Spock must die.
I think you're thinking about the straight to video Star Wars movie Jar Jar Must Die.
Jar Jar Binks Must Die.
Okay, let's get into some discussion here with first impressions. So I've been watching this episode my whole life, not too many years after it first aired, and I've had it in every format that you can think of. Wore out my VHS tape. Of course, now I have it on DVD and Blu-ray. So I cannot remember seeing this for the first time, but Andy, you recently saw this classic episode for the very first time. So I want to hear, what were your first impressions when you saw this?
Well, I loved it. I thought it was easily one of the best episodes of the original series, especially since I hadn't, up to that point, it was definitely one of the strongest episodes. I like how when I went on Standard Orbit to talk about this season, Mike put it as, I just touched the monolith. I had just finished seeing City on the Edge of Forever, and that just blew his mind. No, I loved it. I loved the setup. It's a pretty classic time travel story. And what I really, really liked is finally having a female character that I could get behind. She's Edith Keeler, I think, is easily one of the best, if not the best, female character the show has ever done, and definitely the best Kirk love interest that we have. So that was a really nice added bonus for me. And then just in general, I think the writing's really sharp and it's a really enjoyable episode and I loved it.
Yeah, the best Kirk love interest in TOS, I would say definitely, because it's the only time where he meets a woman where you can tell, like, it's the way she thinks and the ideas that she has, and they're sort of on the same wavelength. You see that with Picard on occasion in TNG.
Oh, but TNG.
You don't see
TNG
it
reference.
With Kirk.
Yeah, Chris. What episode is this from?
I made a TNG reference. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, she makes sense both as a character and as being in this episode, because I think a lot of the time we have these Kirk love interests that just kind of get thrown in, and they don't actually fit very well with the actual arc of the story. It's just like, we have to have a lady, you know, got to zoom in and do slow lighting and cheesy music, and then later Kirk will make out with her, and then we'll never see her again.
Hey,
but Edith Keeler was not that character.
Are you trying to tell me that Kirk was not truly in love with Shauna / Lady Gaga in the Gamesters of Triskelion?
Well, he had to leave her because she hadn't yet learned self-determination. So, you know, he's, I'll be back later, baby, once you've learned, you know, about life.
Is Kirk Ash? I'll see you later, baby.
Andy, I have to say, I agree with your points that she's a great character, but all of the three characteristics that you said that she didn't have, she does have, right? The music does come on, the lights come on when she shows up. It's like very cheesy. Kirk does get to make out with her.
She still gets that.
And then later on, we never see her again. So it's like she is technically exactly like every other love interest.
No, I totally agree. I mean, they can't totally get rid of soft focus.
I got to say, I 100% love soft focus TOS. I love it. I love the music. I'm not kidding or being ironic. I love it every time. If I can make the music right now, I just love that, you know, just the softening of the lens. You're like, oh, thanks. I know where I am now. I just love those TOS marks. I just love it.
And Andy, you should read some of Phillip's fan fiction. He captures that soft focus feel on the page.
That's right.
No, it's not that she doesn't have that, because of course she has to have that. It's just that she has something else to add to the story and a fully realized character development arc, whereas a lot of these other women just didn't.
And I love her real strong American accent. I mean, like, I just feel like I'm in 1930s New York, just in the middle of the city. You know how New Yorkers sound? It's just like that.
Like Captain America.
Yeah.
Well, so, apparently it might have been set in Chicago, so you could have gotten a Mike Ditka accent instead. Da Bears.
Da Bears. Da Bombs. Da Bombs.
Oh, man. I can see, instead of Kirk, it's Mike Ditka throughout the entire
It's just like chewing the whole time. Like, yep. Edith Keeler must die.
Oh, she's got to die. She's got to die.
And I can see the guy in the soup kitchen saying, if she really wants to help a guy in need out, and Ditka looks over, shut up.
Just like George, shut like up, just you. The whole SNL, you know,
pushes
George
him
Witt
in the chest.
And everyone else doing the whole Da Bears sketch.
Oh man, that's funny.
All right, so those are first impressions. Philip, Daniel, do you guys have any first impressions of this that you can, you know, remember, anything you want to share?
Funnily enough, there's the one scene when they're in the basement, like right when they're first meeting Edith Keeler of the mission there, which I think is like one of my earliest Trek memories. I don't remember anything other from the episode at that time, but like later on when I was rewatching that scene, it struck me like I've definitely seen this before, but I've only seen the episode a handful of times, maybe 4 or 5 times. So I'm not like one of those people that has watched it over and over and over and over again.
Why are you looking at me?
But you know, it's funny that for some reason that scene has always stuck out to me, like Spock putting on his little hat there. That's always kind of stuck with me.
Yeah.
The ear hiding hat.
Yeah. Right. And now so on ear hiding, Andy, where does this rate for you?
Oh, it's actually one of my favorites because he uses it again. So, like, what I take from that is he saved this particular hat to bring it back when they went to the Roman planet where they do the gladiating. Is that a word? Gladiating?
No, yeah. Gladiating? That's exactly. That's 100% a word.
Yeah. And to gladiate. He brings that hat along. So he obviously, like, liked it and saved it and took it back with him onto the Enterprise and then brought it back out. And that's pretty cool to me.
Better.
It's no Mr. Miyagi.
I was just
going to
ask, better or worse than
Star Trek 4.
That's definitely the most epic ear hiding I've ever seen. I spit out whatever I was drinking when he puts that headband on. But yeah.
And I couldn't figure out whether it was hilarious or racist or both when they went with electronic rice picker.
oh my goodness.
Well, today, yes.
Which one?
It was written, you know, yeah. Well, you know, that ear hiding cap was very important to Spock, too, because, of course, that was a gift from Mistral, who gave it to him after their trip to Pennsylvania in Carbon Creek.
Yeah, I was also, I think, in this time watching it, and I had never noticed it before, but when I saw the reptilians in the background, that really, I think, brought home this episode for me, and it came full circle.
Illuminati. Yeah.
Have you seen Enterprise yet, Andy?
Nope. I just let it wash over me and I'll figure it out later.
Just let it wash over you like the tides of time. You never know where it might sweep you.
Like,
I don't have to know what Philip is talking about to laugh at him. So.
Only everyone was like you that I meet. and is that a 23rd century soap opera, The Tides of Time? Because I would totally watch it.
The Tides of Time, yes.
The Tides of Time, brought to you by Dilithium Mining Company.
That's not a very original name, Philip. I mean, you would think somebody would come up with something better than that.
Like soap opera, Daniel. Look, it's not rocket science, okay?
All right, fine.
I just want to know who's having Maressa's babies.
kittens. That's the storyline.
Yeah, a whole litter of them.
And also, they're trying to guess the names of Ruby's
yes,
kids.
Exactly.
That's an ongoing story in the Tides of Time. So, okay, well, speaking of Tides of Time, let's talk about the time travel elements of this story. It's hard going back watching this now after so many episodes of Star Trek that deal with time travel, and it became such a trope, and it really, I mean, TNG has plenty of time travel stories. DS9 has a few. Voyager has too many. And then Enterprise has the entire temporal Cold War storyline going and all of its time travel. So it becomes so commonplace by the end of Star Trek's run on television, as we know it so far, that there's nothing special at all, or maybe not even anything very interesting about time travel stories, although I like them myself. But this is the first, really, for me, full-blown time travel story. We did have Tomorrow is Yesterday before this, which does take place in the past all the way through, and then we've got the little bit of time travel in The Naked Time. This one, however, is the one that like everyone really remembers. What do you think about the concepts of time travel that are presented here and the idea that somehow the tides of time are washing you through the timeline and bringing people together, and that's how Bones and Kirk and Spock are all going to come back together at that point?
So the theme, like the idea, the time travel kind of concept that is explored in this episode, I think is really great. This idea that one person can ultimately change everything. And how would you deal with that? And we'll talk later on, of course, about how Kirk deals with that. But that is a really great theme. This setup is like really awkward and sloppy, and I think doesn't make sense. Like the first 10 minutes, if you just get them into the past and then you're like, okay, that's where they are, and now they have to change the future, then that's fine. But like everything up to that, it's like dubious time travel at best. And this was '60s, right? So maybe, I don't know, maybe it hadn't been refined enough in fiction where we could kind of do it a little bit smoother. But it like the fact that like our entire history is gone, like, wait a minute, why are you people still here then? Like, well, I don't understand like what's going on there, or why
they're protected by the Guardian's bubble.
I was just gonna say, or why the Guardian only shows footage from old Paramount films or whatever it was.
Exactly.
They're caught in the temporal wake, Daniel. Didn't you watch First Contact? this is how you.
Once you get into it, it's interesting, and I can definitely dismiss it. It's not a big deal to me, but like just watching those first awkward 10 minutes, like it's. We can't even find McCoy behind this rock over here. He's a foot away right. from us, you know?
Well, I think my favorite part is that the Guardian of Forever is running on Windows 2000. It's like, you know, can't you go any faster? Sorry. Look, this is what I'm programmed to do. This is as fast as I go.
Right.
Like, we...
No, I think he's Windows ME.
Oh, okay. That's right. He is.
It'd be awesome if he got the blue screen of death in the middle of it. Like...
I'd love it if Clippy popped up and said, it looks like you're trying to travel in the past. Can I help you select a destination?
You're trying to fix the timeline? Let me help with that.
You annihilated all of space and time. Well, one thing, and I don't know, this is reading deeply, which I always do, probably too deeply into it, but like I just find the time period a little bit curious, which I know you know, in order to get to World War II, blah, 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 but I'm just trying to think, you know, is there a deeper thing? Because, you know, again, this is what, 1967, 68? Yeah. And so...
66 to 68 yes. for the long history of the writing of this episode.
Yeah, and so this is 30 years ago for them. Is what they're writing, you know, 38. I mean, that's what it's set in. And so I'm trying to think, okay, well, 30 years ago is like the early 80s for us. So, I mean, it's not like this is like outside of their memory. Like this is a generational thing, or even, you know, they all have maybe some memories of the 30s, the people who are writing this, or if not, you know, their parents know it. And so I thought that was a curious choice. You know, if you can put your characters anytime in time, you know, is there a reason you picked this time? You know, and is there something you want to explore about that recent past for you? And so, like, it'd be like us writing, you know, a Star Trek thing that goes back to the early 80s, and that it's curious that we would explore that time. And so I was definitely trying to read into why they chose that time in particular.
I would guess that it's because they aren't quite over the world wars yet. I mean, you're talking about, like, we had the same kind of wars in the 80s. I mean, I don't think we can call the fashion and music of the 80s equivalent to the world wars, right? So I would say that that's probably, it's such a big moment in history, and it's certainly not something that we're done talking about. World War II is probably one of the most talked about and used time periods in all sorts of fiction. I mean, we still watch war stories about that time, so makes sense to me.
Well, I mean, because it'd be like the same, you know, the Vietnam era would be post-Vietnam era, and like the 30s is post-World War One. I mean, obviously I'm not telling over the intelligence, but like that's what they're talking about. When Edith says we were in the war, she's talking about World War One, and getting, you know, and World War II is upcoming. So I think it'd be curious. I mean, it is to me, like, why are they exploring that? And I just think it's interesting that that's when
I think, like, Robert Justman said before that they did intentionally write this as somewhat of a commentary of an anti-Vietnam War movement. At least it's there in the subtext of the episode. And I think if you're going to do that in the late 60s, then you're going to go back to a time where you can use World War One as the backdrop for someone who is trying to move the world towards a less violent future in the lead up to World War II. So you're going to set it between these two great wars as a way of commenting on the war at the moment, which was Vietnam.
Yeah, and again, not to make this a historical podcast, but and I'm sure they weren't doing this on purpose, but it made me think because, you know, this time in the 30s, a lot of people were looking back at World War One, saying, you know, this war, it was just about, you know, trying people to make money. It wasn't like this in democracy, because this is a very isolationist time. And I think that, you know, and it makes me wonder if Edith Keeler is technically an isolationist or something about this pacifism. But anyway, but it just kind of made me think about that whole time period in general.
I never thought about Edith Keeler as an isolationist. That's interesting. But I also find just the time travel, to go back to the time travel, the concepts back in the 60s of how somehow the timeline has a way of would we say a way of correcting itself? I guess if something has gone wrong here, Kirk and Spock are going through, they find Bones and they fix everything. But just the river of time.
Is this like the river of commerce?
It is, yes. I've always found the concepts of time very, very interesting since I was very young. And I don't know, maybe it was in part because of this episode, in fact.
Well, I mean, ironically enough, you know, our most recent Earl Grey that we recorded, you know, as we're recording this, was about the time travel in TNG. And so it's definitely, I know, in Daniel and I's and Invisible Darren's mind. But yeah, I mean, it is, because, you know, we think of sci-fi, you know, like you said, it's the whole staple of time travel. And how Star Trek, you know, the original one, used that, you know, did they go crazy with it or did they do it sparsely or all that stuff? And yeah, they're going to the future, to the past, where, you know, in Assignment Earth, you know, they kind of treat time travel like, you know, it's like turning on a light, you know, light switch. We're just going back in time like you do.
Oh, by the way, we're in the late 60s. Because, no big deal.
And so I think it's interesting that
we visited
that
the
30s,
so let's go visit
because
the
60s. We're on a mission to find out how our world survived the nuclear age, because apparently we have no historical records.
No historical documents on that. Yeah.
And apparently we all survived because of Space Bond and Ninja Cat.
That's right.
Who never
well,
showed
I think
again.
After World War III, did it? I mean, I would think like all the records got destroyed. I always wonder like how they have, you know, everyone remembers Bach and Mozart and all this stuff in Star Trek 24th Century after the World War III wiped out everything, presumably. It's because the Enterprise went back in time, you know, downloaded everything and went back forward and said, hey, we found all the culture.
All the culture.
We found all the culture.
We found all the culture and the humpbacks. So no worries, guys.
Attention, everyone. This is your captain. We have found all the culture.
like we don't know all the probes that followed up. It's like, captain, they're looking for late 20th century television. Television was wiped out in the mid 21st century. Let's go back in time and get a cable box.
You know, it would be like this like intense scene where it's like, sir, we have 92% of the culture. It's good enough. It's good enough.
I can still get more. And that's why, you know, like, that's why they only got public domain stuff in the future, because when they were downloading all the culture.
So really, like probably the Enterprise going back in time, that's responsible for the Sony hack, right? Like they were like just trying to get all the movies that they could.
Maybe that's why our bandwidth is so slow on the internet these days. The Enterprise is downloading everything.
Oh, I thought that was just
sucking
Andy's
all the
fault.
Bandwidth.
I'm pretty sure that's Andy's
yeah,
cat's
it's
fault.
It's my fault, definitely.
Yeah. Don't you know Andy has the you know what I can't remember what it's called from the like the box of the internet from the internet gods, you know, that she keeps yeah. from the IT crowd.
Oh yes, the internet. yes, the internet with the one blinking red light.
Yes.
And then Mary Kat knocks it over in a fit of disdain, and it's all over for everyone.
Well, let's talk about Edith Keeler a little bit more. We talked about her at the beginning.
All right, I'm adjusting my lens. All right, make it a little soft.
Go into soft focus.
Right. Yeah, get soft focus.
Drop your voice, Philip.
Dim the lighting a little bit.
And then I want to have a little slight Deanna Troi accent.
Okay, so are you ready, Philip? Are you ready to pay for the soup?
Well, I know how I'd like to pay the soup if you know what I'm... Wait, why are you giving me that look, Daniel?
shut up. I just want to listen to her. Shut up.
What I find interesting about Edith Keeler, with this being Star Trek, is the idea that she is telling them everything that comes true in the Star Trek future. And yet, if she's allowed to pursue this vision and she gains power and gets the president's ear, then it sounds like she's Marilyn Monroe, doesn't it?
Happy birthday, Mr. Roosevelt. Oh, sorry, let me sit down. Happy birthday, Mr. Roosevelt. Now you can see me.
The future will never happen. And then Germany wins World War II, which, of course, is the other classic science fiction trope now, right? That Germany wins World War II. But we won't get that Star Trek future. And Captain Kirk, the leader of the Star Trek future at this point in television history for us, has to let her die in order to get that future back, so that we get the better future where we don't have the hunger and people use their energy and resources for good and great spaceships fly into space and go to the moon and all the stuff she talks about.
Yeah.
It's sad. I just find it really tragic. He finally finds someone that is awesome and he connects with, and then he has to let her die so we can get the future that humanity deserves, I guess.
Well, it's not the future we want.
Thank you. I was going to do that.
It's the future we deserve.
So I don't know. Is this a thing? I've definitely heard this before, but I don't remember seeing it or listening to it recently. But this idea that this, I think it's a fan theory, that the alternate universe where Edith Keeler lives is essentially the start of the mirror universe. Have you guys heard this before?
She's the start of the mirror universe. No, I haven't heard
yeah,
this
that's
one.
Oh, yeah, that's where I was thinking. That's where the split would happen, essentially.
Interesting. Okay.
But anyways, I brought that up just because, like, it is this I don't know, like, the weird, almost supernatural ability she has to kind of read the situation and just reason or intuit, I guess, all of this information is, like, of course, the line, right, where when she's talking to Kirk and she's like, oh, she sees Spock. She's like, I see him always by your side. That's where he always should be. And I see you from a different place. Like, that definitely goes beyond, like, normal levels of kind of human intuition into some sort of...
Do you think she's a Time Lord?
Yeah.
Well, you know...
Edith Keeler is a Time Lord.
Maybe.
Time Lady. Yeah, and it's one of those things, and I'm sure Standard Orbit has done the show. I know they have. And Andy, I don't know what your thoughts, but, like, if you wanted to sell the original series, Edith Keeler can sell the TOS on you, because she basically explains everything. Okay, Spock's the sidekick, Kirk's the guy in charge, right. The future is really good, and everyone helps each other, and it's awesome. Like, that's how you would sell Star Trek to someone, just use this episode.
Now I'm seeing Joan Collins in the executive's office there pitching the show.
And they harness these great energies, and
even the atom.
Well, it's. I mean, I was almost thinking, like, wow, she's like the female Roddenberry in this episode, because she is just explaining it, with softer features and music and lots of eyeshadow more than I remember him having.
Well, that's how Gene saw her. I think that's that when Gene looked at Joan Collins, that's what happened to him. So they just shoved it.
Is that why she's actually covered in clothes this time?
Yeah, as a female character. True. That's a good point, actually. Yeah.
Well, it's hard to put Joan Collins in these really spacey, bright, sparkly outfits that they give the ladies of the future when we know that nobody would have worn them in the past.
I think you just described Dynasty.
If she were dressed that way in 1930, then it would have been a dead giveaway that she was from the future.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how she knew what was going to happen.
But
if she had been wearing a pantsuit made of scarves, or, a pink number that was missing legs, we would have known. We would have known right away that she didn't belong there.
What about a giant space belt with a big button in the middle that you push?
Google boots.
Everyone passes out.
With no explanation at all. She's just wearing all of these ridiculous things. She's just got like a astronaut helmet on the whole time. There's no reason for it.
It's like, the writers are really tripping during the writing of this episode. Yeah. 60s. You don't know. Well, like, Chris, you bring up a good question, and I don't think I ever thought about this, which I think is stupid because it seems like the obvious thing to think about watching this episode, that here's Edith, who has this brilliant mind, but we should kill her, really. I mean, we don't want her to go too far with these crazy ideas because she'll change and wreck the world. Like, because to me, again, that was sort of like me wondering, what are they trying to say? That, because, they make Edith this wonderful character who I assume they want us to like, which we do. But then they say, well, but then she's going to be pacifist and she's going to stop war. And we need war because World War II was one time. I think Kirk says something about that line. Like, she has these great ideas, but it was at the wrong time. And the message I got was like, World War II, we had to be warful. That was like a moral war. I mean, I'm quote unquote using that word. But, like, that was a moral war. We had to fight that war, you know, and oh, we should be pacifists after, you know, when there's not a Hitler and not a, all this stuff. But to me, it is an interesting, like, thing to, like, I mean, that's almost the debate when you think about Star Trek being this peaceful message. The message in this episode almost like, there's a time for war, you know. Sometimes it's necessary. I almost got that. And so it is to me like a struggle of, like, the peace of the Federation and Starfleet and Star Trek versus, like, well, pragmatic, sometimes you got to go kill people.
Well, it's what we get again in Deep Space Nine.
And it's also interesting because, like, we don't know, like, I agree, Philip, but like, we don't know. I think the first time I watched this episode, I thought what they were going to do was have Kirk kind of hem and haw about what he should do. But he sticks to his guns the whole time. And, you know, at the very end, that's what makes that last scene super powerful. It's like, it's not somebody holding him back. He has to hold somebody else back. He knows it. Like, I don't really think this episode necessarily addresses those issues head on. It's definitely a question that's brought up, yeah. But it's more about what do you do. And once you know the information, it doesn't matter, like, which is right or wrong. It's like, you just know. You have to do something or you don't do something, and it's going to, and you know what the outcome's going to be. So there are times that Star Trek discusses this where it's like, well, what is the right thing to do here? But when you know the end result both ways, it just seems like it's very simple. It's very simple to pick the right choice in that situation anyways.
Another thing that they bring up in this episode that's kind of a theme throughout Star Trek is, like, the needs of the many kind of idea, where they sacrifice this one amazing woman basically because her death will mean a better world for everyone else. And that's a theme that we see repeated after this as well.
Yeah.
But of course, from their perspective, she was always supposed to die. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit different than sacrificing someone. It's just allowing time to take its normal course. You know, what was supposed to happen was supposed to happen. But definitely, yeah, but you can see that in Kirk as well, you know, the needs of the many, because he doesn't want to let her die, but he knows that he has to let go of that in order to save the future for everyone.
And I think one thing that struck me is that not only does Kirk, you know, quote unquote, save her life on the stairs, I was watching, like, towards the end, because, like, not that I don't know what happens in this episode, but, like, walking down the street holding her hand, and he, like, pulls her back at one point when a car is coming. I'm like, no, that could have been it. Why? But I think another thing that struck me knowing, you know, this episode is watching it, like, it kind of reminds me of the whole Shakespeare rule, that you write a comedy as a tragedy and a tragedy as a comedy. Like, this is really a comedic episode. Like, there's nothing but, like, it's one-liners for, like, 45 minutes, you know, this all lighthearted things, and Kirk and Spock, you know, fish out of water, and you know, McCoy, all these one-liners. And it's like, you know, serious beginning, hilarious middle, tragic ending. And it works, I mean, to me, because you have that sort of comedy Star Trek music throughout this whole episode. It's like, you know, oh, golly gosh, you got me, you know, but then you have this tragic ending.
What is Spock's line? But bearskins and
stone knives and
bearskins. Stone knives and bearskins.
You mean Data's line in the 19th yes. century and the two-parter of.
We don't even want to talk about that okay, episode, okay. though. You got to pick and choose your episodes, Philip. That's not a good episode to ever pick, just so you know.
Always choose Data.
Always choose Data. That's right.
That's true.
Yeah. They do have a lot of really comedic moments in this episode. I mean, that whole beginning is pretty funny, too, because McCoy is just absolutely ludicrously over the top hilarious.
I didn't think he was hilarious so much as I just, every time I was just rolling my eyes, like how ridiculously over the top that he played, that it was played. But I mean, it didn't.
I thought it was hilarious.
I am.
You're rolling your eyes at Ninja Bones.
but while we're on the subject, I wanted to say that I'm, you know, I shouldn't be, because I don't watch TOS as much as I watch a lot of Star Trek, but I'm always amazed and surprised every time I go back. Like, of course, you know, Spock and Kirk, like, that's the thing of TOS, like, that's the relationship you want to watch, but I'm always amazed, like, every single time I go back, like, this episode is so spot on Spock and Kirk. This is exactly the kind of the relationship that we've grown to love, that the legendary, you know, relationship that it is, this awesome, you know, best friendship that they have. It's amazing. It's so good. It's so on point in this episode, too. Their interactions with each other is just, you know, I understand why it's so ridiculously iconic, because it's ridiculous.
And I mean, there were points, because I mean, you have to remember that this is a first season episode, for one thing. But like, because there are points in this episode, I mean, like the whole episode to me, like Spock is not being Kirk's XO in this episode. He's being his friend. I mean, that's how, like, I can see that that's how he even calls him Jim at one point, even though he always calls him Captain throughout the episode. And that, I mean, there is sort of that, you know, it's not just stoic first officer, you know, giving logical stuff. He's actually trying to, you know, and then Kirk actually feels, you know, comfortable enough to say, admit, hey, I am in love with her, Spock. You know, that's my current issue that I'm dealing with right now. And, you know, and Spock trying to counsel him through that.
He even calls him Captain when he doesn't call him Captain. Did you ever notice that?
He always does it with his eyes, I noticed.
Well, Philip, he had to call him Jim at one point, because that's when he says, Jim, Edith Keeler must die.
Oh, that's right. Sorry, let me hold on.
That's when you know
it's
really
serious.
Was that
the first time or the second time that he said it, or what? I don't know. According to this 2-inch screen, Jim, Edith Keeler must die.
I know. I didn't realize that Spock was a smartphone user, that, you know, he just likes using that small screen. I mean, most people go to an iPad these days.
I think that's the same size screen as an Apple Watch at this point, right? I think we can say that that thing is so tiny, it's like this big. But anyway.
Well, let's talk about Kirk just a little bit more and the decision that he made, because do you read this episode more as a story about Kirk and fleshing out his challenges as a leader and as the captain and the sacrifice that he has to make?
Well, I mean, I think one thing that strikes me about this episode, and it's one reason why I love the episode, but why I don't love it as much as everyone else, is that, you know, it is a Kirk Spock / McCoy episode. It's not the whole crew. You know, it's sort of like, we'll stuck them in the planet and we'll talk to them at the end of the episode. But nevertheless, that, you know, that aside, with just Kirk and Spock, I mean, you know, I don't know, you know, Andy, having seen all the original series and half the movies, I mean, what is Kirk's most sacrificial moment? I mean, to me, this strikes me as being in the top one or five, other than maybe blowing up the Enterprise.
Giving up something that he really wants. And I mean, they also play Kirk as very lonely quite often. And yeah, he has a lot of love interests, but I don't think we have very many that we actually feel could really be in a long-term relationship with him, and he always goes back and chooses the Enterprise over everyone. But every once in a while, we get episodes where we do see that he is lonely, and it's really sad to me that he finds someone and has to lose her right away.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, with nacelles like that, I would choose the Enterprise every time, too.
I thought you were talking about Edith for a second. I was like, Daniel, time and place,
yeah,
language.
Too, but then I remembered it's Daniel, so he really does mean the nacelles.
No, but, you know, it's true. Like, that's what struck me about watching it this evening when I was watching it, is especially that scene when, you know, the ending scene there when she dies, and because she must die. I don't know if you guys know this, but Edith Keeler must die.
Really?
But it is like, it's like so, oh my goodness, Spock and Kirk are so surprised. McCoy's right there. Hey, and then like he tries to give him, they're all like, hey, what's going on? This is good and great. And then all of a sudden, you know, events turn. And and Kirk makes that decision, right? Like, he didn't even make that decision, because he had already made that decision, at least in my mind. He knew that he was okay. He had to make this happen. But that's what makes it so painful, right? Like that the reaction we get afterwards. And the great line from Spock when he says, no, he knows, Doctor. He knows what he did. And that's what really stuck out to me.
And if I were to overanalyze the symbolism, which is what I always do, you have Kirk making the hardest, or one of the hardest choices, I don't know if you want to say it's the hardest choice, of his life, of his career, and he's hugging one of his best friends, and he has his other best friend right behind him to provide that support. I mean, it's... It's, you know, it. I think it's great Shatner acting. You know, I mean, he is clutching McCoy. Now, he's not just holding him back. He's almost having McCoy hold him back. He's clutching him so hard. And the eyes closed and the face and the, you know, the not obviously, but not showing anything that's happening after that. You hear the car crash, you know, and him just not being able to look. And I think this that whole emotion of the moment is captured so perfectly.
I also really like that the end of this episode is not optimistic. I mean, they almost always end the original series with everybody on the bridge and Kirk gives a nice one-liner and we all go, ha, 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 wasn't
Everyone
that
laughs.
A delightful adventure? Yeah. And this one doesn't end like that at all. It's a very bleak ending, which I thought worked really well in this episode.
I mean,
yeah, definitely.
I think it's what passes for late 60s television cursing, you know. You're basically ending on, let's get the hell out of here.
Apparently the network didn't like that and wanted that to be removed, in fact.
And they said, frankly, my dear.
No, but it really works. Like, he sounds so bitter.
Yeah,
and he does not come out of this well. And there's no quippy one-liner to end on. It's just him being angry and sad.
And if I remember,
I think it's effective.
If I remember correctly, too, he's only lit from one side in that scene, which I thought was actually a really interesting kind of like thematic vision there. Like, basically, he's holding. I get the idea that the idea is that he's holding it together halfway. He's only barely making it through this. And he's like, no, we've done enough. We know. Essentially, that is kind of Janeway's idea of time travel boiled down to one moment. Nope. Not worth it. Let's just stay away from it as long as we can.
When Voyager detects the temporal anomaly, and Chakotay's like, should we plot a course? She's like, let's get the hell out of here. You know, that's what you're saying. Exactly. Yeah. Well, I mean, and y'all are right, because to me, and you already mentioned this, Chris, but like, it kind of reminds me of like the Doctor Who movie with the Eighth Doctor or something. Like, you know, hey, let's go. You can go through time and space. Come on, I can send you anywhere. And it's like, no. And you're like, no, everyone else here would say yes to adventuring through time. And Kirk's like, no, I've had enough of this. I'm going to go back to my quarters and stab things.
I want to be on the bridge with my, you know, family, basically, and have cool adventures that don't hurt me too badly.
Also says something that nobody says anything after that. I mean, I know, of course, dramatically that makes sense. Like, that's the last line of the episode, but the fact that he says, nope, we're out of here, guys, and everybody's like, okay, Captain Kirk says we're out of here. So I mean, it also kind of speaks, the way it's presented speaks to him as a leader, and the fact that people are willing to be like, I could fix all of the mistakes of my past right now, or, you know, I'm gonna follow this guy and do what we do. And that's, I thought that was also kind of striking.
You have like the one red shirt who's like, but I wanted to go, shut up, okay.
I feel like they're kind of giving him space.
Yeah.
At least Spock and McCoy, anyway, know that he's grieving really badly. And sometimes you want to give them space.
Or all of space in Star Trek.
And time.
I'm thinking, if this were a movie, you know how Hollywood likes to leave a door open for a sequel. They would all leave. No one would say anything. It would be very somber. They would all leave, go up to the ship. They would cut back. Kyle would be hiding behind a rock.
Oh, the Britta. The Britta of the Enterprise.
I want to change something.
He would choose something terrible to change and wipe out human history because he's Kyle.
Kyle, you don't even get a uniform, okay? You keep wearing your unitard. You earn a uniform.
Which I not just a unitard, but a red unitard.
And again, it's been a while since I've watched TOS, but I actually didn't remember that the unitards actually do have different colors. There's blue, there's red, you know, there's everything. So.
And Kyle didn't learn that even in your own transporter room, you never wear the red.
Oh, boy.
Because ninja bones will come and knock you out.
Right.
So, I don't know if this is an apt comparison at all.
Oh, it's apt.
And I don't know if this
We don't
is
know a, what it is yet, but...
I don't know if this is a good comparison.
It's apt.
But I imagine, even if somebody had the capability, which I don't think is possible, to knock someone out with a half karate chop to the kidneys and then a half karate chop
to the
back.
Oh, Daniel, that's
neck.
Because you've never been through your Starfleet fighting training.
I assume, like, McCoy is, like, methed out at this point. There's no possible way
space
he could
methed
do this.
Out.
Space methed out. Like, that scene was so silly to me. It was just like, couldn't you, like, he could have had he could have filled that guy with that drug or whatever. Like, there's been 1,000 other ways you could have done that. And it was
yeah,
so
but
silly.
Daniel, we're talking about 100 times the normal dosage of cordrazine. You know what that does to people?
I mean, one or two drops. Didn't you hear the captain's line? It was the way they started
the
episode.
Save a man's life.
But yeah. Yeah.
Bones got 100 times that.
Yeah, it's true.
Now, Chris, I think you can. Kyle. We can bridge or make a bridge between you and Daniel and I. Chief O'Brien never would have allowed this to happen. He would have.
Oh, no.
No way.
He would have knocked
a random
out.
Transporter would never have let that happen. Only Kyle could let that happen. He is the opposite of Batman.
That's right. And the reason you know this is TOS and not TNG. If this was TNG, the way the scene would have unfolded is, you know, the transport chief would have gotten knocked out. McCoy would have beamed, and then you would have gone to the bridge and like, Captain, we're detecting a unauthorized transport. Maybe we should stop it. No, we can't.
Too late. We can't stop it. But we do detect it, and we know where it's going. So I just love the fact. Okay, I'll knock on the first 10 minutes of this episode all day long. So Spock is sitting here like, I'm recording all of human history on my tricorder here. And this is great. It's recording everything. And then like Uhura and Scotty are like, where could McCoy be? And he's like, I'm right behind this rock.
Is he like the dog in Duck Hunt? He goes, and then hides behind the rock.
He's like 3 feet from you. How do you not
behind
know this?
Behind the styrofoam rock. Can't you? It's like, it's not really hiding him.
And not only that, they detain him, and he still gets away. No, McCoy, don't go through the time portal. And it's like, and it's like, oh my god!
And like, is it? I'm trying to remember. It's like one of them like falls down, like getting himself brushing. Ah, what a ball!
No, he pushes, I believe, Kirk and Spock off of him, and they go like they kind of like stumble. Like, no.
He was powered by spaceman. No, Daniel.
That maybe I'm just underestimating the power.
Well, he learned that move from Kirk in A Taste of Armageddon, where Kirk knocks over all the guards like bowling pins with one push.
It's so silly. So funny.
I was also struck by like the oddness of the landing party. It's like, okay, we need to go find McCoy. Let's get all right. Spock, of course, that's just default. I'm gonna have to choose. I'm gonna get the security guys. And Uhura and Scotty. Like, why are you?
Yeah, let's bring the chief engineer down because he'll definitely help us find McCoy.
Right, and we need Uhura to communicate with drugged out McCoy. It's like.
So there are no senior officers on the bridge at this point. Well, there's none.
I mean, you know, Sulu, he's had his.
No, but
he's
still
been thinking about the command track. He's not sure.
He's recovering.
He's still messed up on space mesh.
He's still recovering.
So Chekhov is in charge. No, he's not even on this.
He's not even on
the
ship.
That's
my point. There's
like,
nobody
Kyle's
there.
In charge. No wonder the Enterprise disappeared. There's nothing wrong with time. That was the reason.
Now I'm hearing the theme song in my head, Philip. Charles in charge, but Kyle in charge.
Kyle in charge.
Kyle in charge of the theme song.
It's just like sort of the cheesy like 80s intro where like it's a montage of like Kyle like slipping and breaking like a circuit on the Enterprise.
And then there's an alto sax solo in the middle.
Kyle just, he's like, I just want to take the ship for a spin around the block. I swear nothing bad will happen. It's totally fine. And then like goes into a black hole or something like that.
No, but like we can't reach the
That's
ship.
The same thing Harriman said, Daniel, and you know how that turned out.
Yeah, exactly.
See, that's the mirror universe right there. That's the...
Captain Kyle, as I was saying, that's like the worst Kyle. Scenario.
It's the darkest timeline.
The darkest.
Well, doesn't Kyle get the goatee in Star Trek 2?
Yeah, he does. Yeah. I also like, Daniel, you mentioned Spock recording history. I like that he uses the word tape. He says, I've missed taping centuries of living history.
I know, he could have gotten so much culture. He could have gotten most of the culture.
Almost all of it.
Most of the culture.
Oh, man.
That's how Riker got jazz, because Spock was recording during that moment.
How many cultures? How many culture points did you get, Scott? Spock? I got 82 culture points. We didn't.
Me change Spock's character sheet. He's now plus 80 culture.
Yeah, I don't know. I think Riker may have got hooked on jazz after his little rendezvous with T'Pol.
Yeah,
that we don't know about.
Well, yeah, that's certainly possible.
Little time in the decon chamber. Why do you think the Titan has a decon chamber, even though they don't need one in the 24th
century? Are you saying there's an NC-17 version of the holodeck program Riker ran in These Are the Voyages?
Philip, there are NC-17 versions of all of Riker's programs.
Troy's like, and what is this part of the program all about? And he's like, oh, we don't need to see that one.
Let's just say that the cafe that Minuet was in, the other version of that program takes place in Amsterdam.
You would probably still invite Picard because that was still a creepy part of that episode.
I had no idea Skeletor was anatomically correct. Oh my goodness. Oh boy. We're going a little off the rails here, I think.
We're going through time.
Yeah, we are. We're sure. We're going off the rails. We're sure.
Yeah.
Usually she's here for that. All right. Well, let's wrap up with just some final thoughts and the legacy of the episode and ratings. Anything else you have here, Philip? How about you?
Yeah, I think it sounds so stupid. You know, this is the most classic episode of TOS, and I'm going to be like, well, it's not my favorite. And they're like, just shut up, Philip. But I'm going to say that because the reason it's not my favorite as it is everyone else, it's my same reason for The Inner Light in TNG. Everyone thinks, well, that's the best. It's like, it's not my favorite because it's a great story. Don't get me wrong, City of the Edge of Forever, but it's not in space. It's not with the Enterprise crew. It's not on the Enterprise. You know, that's like all of Star Trek. It's like, it's basically the Spock and Kirk show featuring McCoy and the past, you know. So it's you know, I mean, that's to me, it's not what Star Trek is. But, you know, that aside, of course, it's a great episode. And there are
except for all those things I just named
that
make it a bad Star Trek episode. It's a great one.
Yeah, I mean, Uhura acts like a... moron.
Oh, Uhura, yes. I was going to mention, Uhura is like the fear equivalent of that person who never laughs and just says, that's funny.
Right?
I'm frightened.
Why is she so weird in this episode? It's so strange to me.
Andy, why is she so weird? You're the girl.
Because they couldn't handle writing two awesome female characters in one episode for TOS.
Hey,
oh, they used up all their... female awesomeness on
I was just gonna
Edith
say,
Keeler.
They yes, did write exactly. two female characters. That's pretty impressive. At the same time, kind of.
They never talk to each other.
I don't know. There was that yeoman on the bridge at the beginning. She had a good character development of how she held
Sulu. Did she
Sulu.
Bring something to Kirk to sign? Because I'm pretty sure that's what all they do is bring him food.
Sometimes they bring him coffee and chicken sandwiches.
And soup.
Sometimes they bring the Dixie cups out.
And so, based on all that, that pretty much sums up my feelings. And so, I give it 4 assassins, killers, out of 8.
Out of
Very
8?
Good.
Yep.
Yeah, that's a yes. half ratio. That's pretty low.
Rating out of 8. That's interesting.
Oh, the ratings, Andy, on the Ready Room, they don't mean anything.
They're like
oh, okay.
they're
completely
like,
random.
The rest of Edith Keeler's life.
Oh.
Wah, wah, wah.
Too soon?
They're like whoever's pants that Kirk and Spock stole. They don't matter. Yeah. They don't need pants.
They are poor people. This is depression. They needed those pants. It's the only pants they have.
What if there had been a scene, people walking around on the street, and this guy like randomly walks by from time to time in the episode with no pants on?
Is anyone going to make the no, because this is the only episode where I knew to look for it, they're walking in Mayberry quote here.
Oh, yeah,
it's
yeah.
like Floyd's Barbershop. They're just chilling over there.
Oh, yeah. yeah.
All right. How about you, Daniel?
Yeah, I mean, oh, man. Like I said, besides the setup, essentially, of the episode, which is hard to take seriously under any circumstances, I feel like, it is an episode that does big ideas really well. And like I said, the Kirk and Spock thing is spot on. And then the payoff is phenomenal. And so I don't have anything bad to say about this episode. I mean, and I understand why people love it as much as they do. And I would definitely put it on my top 10 TOS list, probably. It's just not, it doesn't, I don't know if it resonates with me as much as it does with a lot of fans, maybe because I didn't grow up with it or I didn't experience it. I think it's great. I'm not saying it's bad at all. So I would probably give it 6.5 McCoy Space Meth Karate Chops.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's lethal.
I'm pretty sure it's lethal.
All right. How about you, Andy?
I love this episode. It's definitely one of my favorite episodes of the original series, and Edith Keeler is one of my favorite characters. So I would say it's definitely in my top 5 of my favorite TOS episodes, and I just think not only does the plot work, but the characterization works, and the tone of the episode is great, and I personally love it from top to bottom. If Kyle was taken completely out of it, I would probably give it a million times more points, but this time I'll give it 5 Spock ear hiding hats.
Ooh. Now I was watching this on Netflix, and this is the remastered edition without Kyle. Were you not watching that one?
They remastered the entire original series to just remove Kyle from everything.
Yeah, it was very controversial, but, you know.
Not
Kyle
to
shot
me.
First!
All right. Well, I love this episode as well. And perhaps I love it because, as I said at the beginning of the show, I've been watching it since I was a kid. But also, for me, what I like about science fiction and the kinds of stories that you can tell through science fiction, this really fits that mold very, very well. So not only is it a classic Star Trek story for me, it's really a classic science fiction story. It's amazing that when I think, okay, something that, and I didn't ask you, Philip, actually, which TNG episode does this most remind you of?
I mean, for the time travel aspects, it was the two-parter. I can't mention because Daniel will kill me. Because you sort of have Data as Spock, you know, building things and all that stuff. But from a sacrifice level, I don't know. I mean, Daniel, you can, you know, you're one third of this alliance. You know, there is sort of a lessons. Inner light feeling in some ways because, yeah, you know, the sacrifice.
Well, for me, I think of on TNG yesterday's Enterprise and the complete mess behind the scenes that it was to write that episode and get that episode produced. Mm-hmm. And yet it turned out to be one of the great classic episodes of TNG. And this episode as well is just such a mess. The only lines from Ellison's original teleplay that remain in this episode are the Guardian of Forever saying, "Since before your sun burned hot in space, since before your race was born," and then time has resumed its shape at the end of the episode. And that's it. And it was rewritten by Stephen Karabatsos. It was rewritten again by Harlan Ellison, Gene L. Kuhn, DC Fontana, and then even Gene Roddenberry, to finally get what we got on screen, which as far as Star Trek is concerned, I think is far better than what Ellison originally wrote. And
don't tell him.
Just shows how the creative process works for me as well, which I like as a creative. So many, many things that I really love about this episode. And it just really will be, probably always be a classic for me. It's probably in my, I don't know, top 5. Of all Star Trek episodes. So I'm going to give this one 10 McCook versus Mason boxing posters. Which, of course, that poster does show up again later on in Star Trek. Does anyone remember where?
Deep Space Nine?
That's right.
Is it past?
No, it's past tense that it shows up there?
Yep. Past tense, when Miles and Kira beam down.
Oh,
one
right.
One of the streets where they beam down, the poster's there on the wall.
And Miles has to ask the person, what's pay-per-view? And
and then they ask Kyle, what the hell are you doing?
Oh, I think
get out of here, Kyle.
Guys, we can only have one guy with an accent on this show. You can't do it.
Let's not spoil the inevitable surprise that Andy's going to reach when she gets to Deep Space Nine, that Kyle is a major character.
Yeah, there's the crossover emissary. Yeah. You know, he's like, this is my favorite transporter room. And, you know, that I get my ass kicked in. You know, yeah.
I mean, I feel like you're kidding, but I'm also terrified you're not.
Oh, you'll see.
You'll see.
That's ominous.
I like the version on the DVDs where they actually have Kyle singing the DS9 theme song.
Oh, man. Oh, boy.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us today, guys. Before we go, Daniel, tell everyone where they can find you around the internet and elsewhere on the network.
Well, they can find me along with Philip here, of course, and our other co-host who is absent, Darren, on our TNG show here on the network every week on Earl Grey.
Earl Grey? Wrong one.
No, we don't do that.
Is that a thing?
But, you know, we have a great time every single week talking all things TNG, so you should definitely take a listen over there if you're interested in our you know, Lieutenant Kyle commentary. I think we just did that pretty recently, so... you know, we're looking forward to more coverage in the future.
So you're telling me that our TNG show is called Earl Grey?
It is.
I could have sworn it was Darjeeling.
Oh, well, you know, it's... well, and as you can tell from Daniel's hair, he looks like never mind.
A what? A young Picard that was cloned DNA that came from Beverly's wedding?
That is not what young Picard...
Did you ever even watch Tapestry? Oh my god. But then of course other than that, they can get a hold of me on Twitter, and my handle there is at OneUpDan. That's the number one, not the word.
Excellent. And Andy, tell everyone where they can find you and tell us a little bit about your show, Women at Warp.
Okay, so the easiest way to find me is on Twitter. I am live tweeting the first time I watch Star Trek, so it's aptly named at First Time Trek. I'm about to watch Star Trek V, and Daniel, don't say anything. No,
it's not sigh. It's not just me. Don't expect it to be just me. I'm just saying.
And then I also recently launched Women at Warp with three other women, where we talk about Star Trek, and it's really, really fun, and you can find us at womenatwarp.com.
Now, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on Star Trek V, because I kind of like the movie. I mean, it's my least favorite probably of all the films, but there are things that I do really like in there, so I'm curious to hear.
Yeah, I mean, I've got 5 and 6 left, and then I'm moving on to DS9, so it'll be interesting to kind of finally end my TOS journey.
So you're skipping the animated series?
I'm coming back to the animated series.
Because Kyle is in the animated series, if I remember correctly.
But
well,
also,
then I'm never watching it.
An animated Kyle, he's really got it all together.
Which he probably does as much movement as the non-animated Kyle.
And let's also not forget, we know how much of a fan that Andy is of cats. So Star Trek V might be her favorite Star Trek.
And the animated series does have a cat character as a main in the main cast.
True. That's right. All right. Well, thanks again, guys, for joining us today.
Thank you.
Bye.
Well, Chris, it was great to have Andy and Daniel on to talk about the old original series and the fan favorite episode. And hopefully we did the fans well, talking about what everyone considers the best episode of the original series.
I noticed you referenced the fans there and everyone. Are you trying to distance yourself from this?
Well, no, as I explained, I like it, but it's, you know, I say it's a fan favorite. I'm sure there's, you know, I've looked at TNG as a TNG guy. I've looked at the fan favorites list and don't always agree with them. I don't know about you. Well, like, I know you're, if I can pick you with a thing, Enterprise, right? What's everyone's favorite fan favorite episode of Enterprise in A Mirror Darkly? And I know you have your thing that you would pick on that, so.
Yeah. Well, it's just not a very good story. That's
right.
So, whereas this is a very good story.
It is.
All right. Well, yeah, it was great. And it was fun turning the tables here and having two TNG guys, although you guys both know TOS quite well, and Andy, someone who has seen this episode for the very first time only recently, for maybe a little bit of a different discussion than we would have had if we had gotten, you know, four long-time TOS guys like me together to just completely fanboy over the episode.
Yes, and Andy, who only knows TOS and TNG, so that's very interesting.
Oh, that's true at this point.
That's right. Because really, that's all you need to know, right? Yep.
You mean there's more Trek after that?
No, I don't know. They stopped after 1994. I think they made a movie. That was about it.
Of course, as everyone knows, Deep Space Nine has become my favorite of all the series, so I'm only kidding here. All right. Well, it was a good discussion today, but City on the Edge of Forever is only one of the things we've been talking about here on the network recently. So here's a quick look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
And I think it was a very anticlimactic thing for a lot of people because they were expecting me to do, you know, my rah and ranting thing, but instead I just was like, oh, that's depressing. Okay, bye.
Earl Grey.
They've now shifted into the Biff-controlled 1985.
Who got a hold of the almanac in order to turn yesterday's Enterprise?
The Enterprise C is the DeLorean in this scenario.
The Orb.
I'd like to see the Borg assimilate Ferenginar, and then they would become bankers. You know, I could see...
Oh my gosh,
I could see
bankers.
Drones. Yeah, yeah.
The world's strictest bank ever. Right. I'm sorry, you have not paid your loan. You will be assimilated.
The nanites go into you.
Yes.
To the journey!
I kind of want something with a little bit more teeth. For some reason, like starting a garden just doesn't scream mirror universe to me.
Starting a garden doesn't have teeth.
The Ready Room.
I hate to put it this way, but maybe in some strange... twisted logical sense, if Archer just kind of flew on by and didn't help the colonists, the Enterprise D would have never crash landed on Viridian 3.
So it's not Troy's fault, it's Captain Archer's fault.
Literary Treks.
This is something that doesn't get done a lot in books because I don't think the time period's supposed to be that long.
Mm-hmm.
But what did you end up thinking about having a story take place before where no man's gone before?
Well, I thought personally that it was really cool.
The 602 Club.
My two favorite scenes in the film are Cap saying language and then the rest of what the jokes that go with that, and then Cap moving the hammer just enough, then Thor's face when he can't pick it up is priceless.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You can find us everywhere that you get your podcasts. Of course, we're in iTunes, also Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, Windows Phone, BlackBerry. Apparently, Philip, some people still listen to podcasts on BlackBerry. So we are there. Are you one of them?
Well, I assume, I know President Obama, that's what he uses. And so I know he's a big Star Trek fan. Maybe that's what he listens to us on.
He does. Brock sent me a message and he said, I only listen to you on my BlackBerry. Because that's the only way they'll let me listen to you.
It's true, yeah.
He said he really loved our Gamesters of Triskelion episode.
Yeah, and I mean, he's a big Spock fan, so I'm sure he said, Chris, I really enjoy your Leonard Nimoy episodes, and I hope you do more.
Exactly. Yeah. That's exactly what it sounded like. All right. But yeah, you can find us in all these places. Also on SoundCloud, or go to our website and you can stream from the show page there. You can also download the MP3 file. There's a little link in the SoundCloud player on the show page. And also there's another player further down, which has a download link. And you can grab the RSS link if you would like to put that into some kind of third-party application. So we try to make it as easy as possible for you to get the Ready Room and all of our shows here on the network. While you're in iTunes, if you want to help us out, it would be wonderful if you take a moment and leave us a star rating and a written review. We love to hear what you think about the show, and also those ratings and reviews help us rise up in the search results in iTunes, and that makes it easier for Star Trek fans to find the Ready Room and our other shows as they're searching for Star Trek podcasts. So please take a moment and let us know what you think. Now, another way you can help us out here on the network is to support us through Patreon. We are a listener-supported network, and with all the programming that we produce every day, it costs us quite a lot of money to operate Trek FM. If you would like to contribute to the network, you can do that in any amount that you like on a month-to-month basis through Patreon. Just go to patreon.com/trekfm, and you'll see the different perks that we have available, but you can set any amount that you like, and even $1 really does make a difference for us here on the network. And we'd also like to thank our associate producer, Renee Roberts, who supports us through Patreon. And in fact, Renee has been a big supporter of the network ever since I started things back at the end of 2010. I want to say probably early 2011 is when I met Renee, and she's been with us the whole time. So I really appreciate all of Renee's support. Thank you so much, Renee. And everyone, send her a thank you. You can find her on Twitter. Mariss_1701 is her username. And in fact, we talked quite a bit about Mariss today, didn't we, Philip? Although I can't remember if it was on the air or on the other side of the room.
The other side of the room.
Well, we know how important Mariss is. And Mariss, Andy does not know you yet, both you or your character, but hopefully we can remedy that someday.
Absolutely. All right. Well, if you'd like to share your thoughts on today's show, there are many ways for you to get in touch with us. You can find us on Twitter. Our username is TrekFM. We also have a page on Facebook, and we also have a group on Facebook. It's our closed group for listeners called the Babel Conference. And we have, how many members do we have in there now, Philip? It's, I think, about 600 or so. It's really growing.
I think we have more delegates than there are, you know, stars in the sky at this point. And I think what the selling point, not only is it because it's about Trek FM, that's the biggest selling point, of course, that's what you're listening to right now. But another biggest selling point is, I don't want to say it's the only one because that would be disparaging others, but it is one of the few Star Trek communities where all discussions are respectful and it's a Star Trek family discussion. I don't mean it's family friendly necessarily, but like it's a family,
it's pretty family
in that
friendly.
We may disagree, but we disagree with respectfully, and everyone always comments that they love to be a part of an internet community where all trolls are instantly vaporized.
That's right. Just like the guy who found McCoy's phaser.
That's right. Never choose
Facebook. Yeah, that's the thing. You know, we have great discussions there, but it is a closed group. That's why it's a closed group. And we only promote it here on the air. So if you're not a listener, you're probably not going to find it because Star Trek is not in the name of the group. It's the Babel Conference. And the way you get there is to type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook or click discussion on the menu bar on our website. Those will both take you there. Just click join and we'll let you right in there. And if you're tired of all the petty bickering and the whining and just the general negativity that you find in online groups these days, which unfortunately seems to be the norm, then come over to the Babel Conference. I think you'll really enjoy it. It's the reason we created it in the first place, is to have that kind of discussion.
The Babel Conference is the celestial temple of Star Trek discussions. You can't find it unless you know where to look.
That's right. And then it's all white everywhere. And past, present, and future have no meaning. All right. Now, if you're not on Facebook, because we know not everyone is on Facebook, and you want to send us email, you can do that by going to trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. Just choose to send to a show and choose the ready room, and that will come to me by email. And you can also send voicemail by going to speakpipe.com/trekfm. And you just need the mic on your smartphone, your tablet, or your computer, and you can upload that file right there from the page. And we would love to hear from you by voice as well. All right, Philip, when you're not, you know, playing around trying to figure out just how much cordrazine gives you that buzz but doesn't make you go crazy and jump through time portals, where can people find you?
Oh, I love having that stupid smile on my face. But they can find me, of course, as Daniel said, each and every week here on the network on Earl Grey with Daniel, Darren, and myself talking all things TNG and which episodes of TNG the episodes of TNG remind us of. And, of course, they can find me on Twitter. My handle is at NC Public Servant. That's NC for no cordrazine.
All right. Well, if you want to find me, you can find me on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones, letter C and Brian with a Y. I'm also on Facebook, and you can find me there in the Babel Conference as well, having Star Trek discussions. You can find me on my personal website at cbrianjones.com, where I write about things other than Star Trek. And also, you can find me here on the network doing The Orb with Matthew, where we talk only Deep Space Nine. And sometimes I do Hyperchannel as well, which is a short new show. And you'll find me on past episodes of various different shows. If you go back, I did cut back on my podcasting here around the beginning of the year, as I have, you know, taken over a magazine here in Tokyo now. So I don't have as much time to sit behind the mic as I would like. But yeah, one of these days, I'm hoping so.
Well, I know the last time I was at the Guardian Planet and the Guardian of Forever was talking about Trek.fm, the old things he was showing me were all your old shows. And I can step through at any moment and listen to your old shows.
Oh, all right. I'll have to make sure I step through to the right one. Well, Philip, I'm going to head out now. Now that Bones has recovered, I want to see if he can teach me some of those smooth karate moves.
Oh, Ninja McCoy. Well, Chris, it's time to stick a hypospray into it with a sound effect that takes about 15 seconds too long to produce because the ready room is done. Recording.
Waveform.
I am the guardian of recording.
The waveform. And I need pants on, don't I? Waveform pants on the edge of forever.
Wait, my pants no longer exist now.
See, what if McCoy jumps through and suddenly the crew's naked?
That's the only difference. She eliminated clothing from the future.
Everyone's in mini skirts.
Kirk says, clothing is not there. At least, not as we remember.
And then instead of the camera going up, it goes down to the legs.
Right, and it stops on their toes. And then roll the intro.
Boy, that'd be uncomfortable for Uhura, I think. But
all right, here we go. I'll lead us in.